My name is Jared J.B. Boyd. Welcome to Stereo Sessions. I'd like to welcome you to this experience that we do at WYXR. Each year we pick six records that we feel expand most people's understanding of the Memphis sound. You know, we are the home of rock and roll, blues and soul, and but we're the home of many other things, of jazz, of psychedelic, of pop, of power pop, of so many things. One of these days we'll do a reggae record maybe. We've done gospel. We've done all sorts of things. And Memphians are always pushing boundaries. And whether it be the artists themselves, engineers, producers, people who exemplify a moment in time here in this city. Maybe they recorded here. Maybe they grew up here. Maybe they were just passing through, like the New Zealand Trading Company that we honored one time. But these stories illuminate these moments. And so it's our distinct honor and pleasure to be able to honor these records. People ask how we choose them. It's not that complicated of a criteria. I mean, one is, does it expand that definition of the Memphis sound? But two is, do we have two copies of the record that we can play out here and in there? Two good copies. And also, is there someone who we know that we can get here to talk about it, who can share their stories? And so this one, I think, is one, if I may speak for Robbie, that Robbie has wanted to do for quite some time. And we're really, really fortunate to have members of the band here tonight. I think this may have been probably, not, I won't say the hardest logistically, but probably the most that we've had to be intentional about the logistics of getting someone here that isn't already presently living in Memphis to be able to speak to a record. And this one's been a record we've been passionate about for quite some time, that Robbie shared with me years ago when we were just getting to know each other. Like, you know, what are the things that I like? What are the things that you like that, you know, make you feel great about Memphis and music? And so I'm excited to take a step back tonight and sit and listen with you all. I am going to be hanging back and letting Robbie be the pilot. That's a little inside joke there. But before I can do that, I'd like to thank our friends at Mempho Presents, Memphis Listening Lab, Via Productions, Crosstown Brewing Company, Independent Bank, Sean and Shauna Lynch, and Duncan Williams Asset Management, who helped us to, we get a special kudos to them that helped us to put this cocktail hour together. I said, we can't have another cocktail hour with just wine and beer. They got to be cocktails next time, right? Wine hour or whatever. We'll either change the name or change the menu. But either way, I'm JB. Y'all feeling good? Y'all feeling all right? Y'all know we're going to do an A and a B thing. If you stay out here and then you go in, just find somebody next to you that knows what's up. All right, Robbie, you ready to rock? Let's do it. All right. Here's the human side of radio.
Thanks, JB. Give it up for JB, program manager. This stereo session has been his baby and has been pretty incredible. So, yeah, like JB said, every year he lets me pick one record, just one, sometimes maybe two. And this record means a lot to me. I graduated high school in 91 and, you know, starting to play music around that, you know, been playing music all through high school, mostly cover music. And then we started writing music, like, you know, in 89, 90, and heard about this band Human Radio and heard they got signed. And it was like, oh, my God, you know, this is incredible. And, you know, for us as formative musicians, seeing someone get out there, seeing a band get out there and just work it and create an incredible record was inspiring then, has really been inspiring, you know, all throughout my entire life. So this is exciting for me. So without further ado, I do want to go ahead and bring the members of the band that are here. First up, Ross Rice. Let's give it up for Ross Rice. All the way from Troy, New York. So we're happy to have him. Out of Nashville now, Steve Eby. Come up, Steve Eby. Very nice. And then I guess lurking in the shadows somewhere, Peter. There he is. Peter Herka back there. He's sitting with the television people in the back, I guess. So. All right. Well, gentlemen, have a seat and we can get started. Ross, how you doing?
Excellent.
Okay. Well, I'm really happy to have you. Excellent. Peter here. Come on, Peter. Get out.
Hey,
here.
What's up? Hey, y'all.
So as you heard, you guys are spread out now away from Memphis. No original members in Memphis anymore, but you formed here and you all lived here. Ross, tell me a little bit about how the band got together, how you became friends, and started playing music together.
Well, it kind of all started at Memphis State University, or the University of Memphis, yes, if you will, where I was going to school from 79 to 83. And around that time, they built a studio over there at Memphis State University. And, of course, the studio was completed the year I was leaving, so... but I was determined to get to use that studio anyway, so I got to know the great Dan Pfeiffer, who was running that studio, and Dan, he needed somebody to record, so I had some songs to record, and so he let me come in and do that, and we'd record him, and I would also have my best friend at the time, Kai Kennedy, who some of you may have known from the band Calculated X, the great band Calculated X, and he was also going to high school with me, and so... When I was in college, he had left and gone out on tour with the Department of Defense. But
a band.
Long story.
That's a band.
Yeah, long story.
Yeah.
But anyways, so Kai and I had some songs that we were writing together, and we had these ideas that we wanted to sort of work together. We're just good friends and writing songs, and we came up with a batch of songs there at Memphis State University, which when Dan Pfeiffer got hired at Memphis Sound Productions, which is where the Hard Rock Cafe ended up being on Beale Street later, and I guess that's even now gone. Yeah. But at Memphis Sound Productions, there was a brand new studio there. Dan was working there, and he played our stuff for Tim Goodwin and John Fleskus, who were the people that were running that studio. And Tim and John were pretty knocked out by that stuff and wanted to offer us a production deal, if you will. So Kai and I said, okay, sure, what the heck, let's do it. If we can go there and record stuff, we'll do that. So we ended up going, getting together with Tim and John over there at that studio and recording more of our stuff there. And there was some momentum behind the project, and Haynes Knight became part of the team there and became part of it. And we started, then there's this idea we need to have a band to sort of form behind or around this idea. So we started putting the feelers out for people. And first of all, we found out that Steve Eby was around, and he was very highly recommended, also a very, very respected drummer in the area. And we thought, well, it'd be great to have Steve Eby in this band. So we got him. And then Steve was also, his roommate at the time was Steve Arnold. And Steve Arnold was playing with another band, and Steve Eby, I guess you can probably tell him this part of the story if you want.
So. I had gone to rehearse with a band that was trying to form, and there's a young bass player who had just moved back to Memphis from going to college out in L.A. His name was Steve Arnold. I'm like, this kid is amazing. Who is this guy? Where did he come from? And I immediately just poached him and stole him and took him to Human Radio. And
yeah, so he got poached.
That story.
So we had four of us, and then there was this idea that we needed a fifth member, and so we were trying to think about how, what we're going to do about that. And Kai Kennedy apparently was having an evening with Peter Herka, and Peter, maybe you can tell him what happened that night. Actually, well, if you can't, I can.
Excellent. I had to make this up because I don't remember.
Okay, I'll do it.
Basically, all right. I didn't have a pilot's license. That was the main contender because you were going to get Sal Crocker.
Oh, I was not. All right, that's enough of that. Well, that part of the story is incidental.
I've got a version of the story that the people can hear.
Okay, give it to them.
We had been rehearsing, but the band was incomplete. And we weren't in a great mood because the band was incomplete and we'd been working at it. And we went to the North End to drown our sorrows, and this guy was playing there with Victims of Circumstance. And he came over and said, what are you guys doing? And we said, well, we're having a rehearsal. And Kai says to Pete, well, Pete, once our band is going, man, you should come sit in some night. And he goes, I should sit in every night. And then he went back up on stage, and we went,
Okay. So he
and
did.
So he did.
So he did. And we had our fifth member, and so we were a complete group at that point. And we found ourselves just trying to work things out. We had a production deal. Now we just had to get gigging. We had to start playing. Yeah.
So South End.
So we got ourselves a Wednesday night at the South End.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And
was a fun gig.
It's just, we started that gig, and next thing you know, it built up, and we found ourselves with a bunch of people that wanted to see the band.
And Steve, what was that like? Like, did you know Ross's songs? I mean, what was your approach when you joined Human Radio? Like,
They had a few demos that they were able to give me, and I think some of it had programmed drums, and had you played drums on a few things? Yeah. And so there were some parts already created, but Kai and Ross and I remember meeting a few times as we were trying to form the thing, and the hardest part was deciding on a dang name for the band, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But I could tell immediately that the music was something I cared about and wanted to be a part of.
Yeah, the songs are great, and yeah, that's cool. And then, Peter, you came in. Your instrument a bit unusual in the rock context, especially back then. How was that for you? Like, what was that trying to fit into that mold there?
I got to tell you, classically trained, playing orchestras and all kinds of situations, studio stuff, and my own little jazz group before this, and so I know about intonation and performing and improvising and stuff. Mm-hmm. But it's funny, we started me and Elvis, and David Kahn came to produce us. David Kahn produced David Letter and David Kahn.
We're jumping ahead in the story a bit.
Yeah, but he said, I was playing that tune with me and Elvis, and I wasn't, he says, play. He goes, we were doing that thing at Proud Mary's, whatever, down there. And he says, play. And so I came up with melodies between the, you know, he told me, you know, it's like, anyway.
Yeah.
So my take is that I listen to a lot of world music. Mm-hmm. I'm classically trained. I've had a bluegrass band, this jazz group. I'm all over the fucking map, you know. I get bored real easy.
Yes. Well, we'll try to keep you entertained tonight. What? So Ross, you gotta. So you have these songs. You're playing out. You're rehearsing, and then like what? You know, people don't know. I mean, it's a pretty quick move to where you guys had a record deal. Came out on Columbia. Your record came out on Columbia in '90. And I mean, that was a big deal. I mean, how did that happen?
Well, that happened kind of, everything really happened fairly quickly with this band. I mean, it was in a lot of ways, our we had a quick arc up and a quick arc down. It was fast. Everything about this band was fast. So
we'll do down later, and
we'll
do that
about
fast.
The down part later. But no, at the time, we sort of took off a little bit, especially we started in 1988, and then in 1989, people started showing up, and a lot of you folks probably started showing up. I see some of the people in the room I are familiar from that. People started coming to the Wednesday night gigs, and that sort of helped us get us sort of more interest in the band. We started playing 616 and then the New Daisy and some of the other venues. And the Antenna Club, even though they weren't really doing too much at that particular time,
Steve McGee.
I recall. but for us, what ended up happening is we as a result of this production deal that we had, and we were able to make some good quality recordings. We also secured management and local management, and the management was very helpful for it having us sort of integrate with the business, because we had no idea what to do about it. We just wanted to play music and you know, have long hair and be cool and whatever, and do our thing and drink
word.
A bit. Yeah, you know what I'm saying? So, I mean, we didn't really understand the business aspect of it, and so we secured some management, local based management, and that was actually a very important step for us, because that kind of had somebody that was actively working on our behalf in the business and sort of looking and talking to people in the business. But around 1989, for some of you all that you're here may remember, things were getting pretty hot around here. There was a bunch of producer showcases, and those producer showcases were generally yielding of, I mean, there was one showcase where there were eight bands that played, and I think three of them got signed, and we were one of them. So there was a lot of activity.
Who were the other? Do you remember who the other?
I think Rob Junkless had already been signed by then. I'm trying to think of who the other
Kilzer. I know Kilzer. I don't know.
Prior to that. Yeah. But
I'm thinking Gun Bunnies.
The Gun Bunnies.
Little Rock, Gun Bunnies.
There was the Gun Bunnies from Little Rock with Chris Maxwell.
Okay. Yeah.
There was some other and some other groups, but
yeah,
there was kind of a hot. It was a hot time for being in Memphis at right about that time for getting some attention nationally. So. Yeah. We sort of benefited from a moment in time in Memphis that was kind of a good time for us to be coming up, and plus we had some assistance with that with our management. So the result we also had a really strong advocate in Paul Worley, who was at the time one of the main people at Sony Tree in Nashville, and he had come to see the band and was knocked out by us. And so a lot of the buzz that we started getting for the band was a result of his interest in us. And between them
making calls that we couldn't make.
Yeah, there were these people were on the right. phone helping us out.
You're right out of college.
So we were. So and what ended up happening is that there was a buzz that was getting generated about the band nationally. I mean, in the music business. So what happened for us is that there were some folks were checking us out. There was someone from Chrysalis came to see us. Mm. And they made us a sort of a minor offer, a very small sort of developmental offer that our management was able to sort of turn that into, oh, hey.
There's interest.
They're getting an offer. Yeah. So. Mm-hmm. And little by little, the interest got to the point where there was a guy named Larry Hamby from Columbia Records that came and flew in to see us. And we actually did a gig on Beale Street at what used to be Proud Larry's or on Beale Street or right next to the New Daisy, the venue right next to the New Daisy.
What?
And we did a gig there. We blacked out all the windows. It was at noon. We played at noon. We had our whole light show. We had Pat Thomas in with our big light show. Because that was another big thing about our band is we had a light show. We had a light show. We paid dearly for that light show. But we had a light show.
Yeah, we did. We took him in the truck.
Yeah.
It hurts when you Penske, and he was with us the whole way.
Yeah.
That was Kyle Miller, by the way.
Indeed. So... So we played a showcase for an A&R guy from Columbia at noon on Beale Street. The guy comes in from the airport, walks into the door. We start playing. We play a 25-minute set. He then gets up and leaves and takes the plane out, and we're going, what the hell happened here? And then then 2 days later, we get the call saying, would you guys like to be on Columbia Records?
Wow.
And we were really interested in David Kahn because we loved Fishbone. That was one of the bands that we loved. We loved a lot of the records he did. So we figured this guy gets us. Columbia Records likes us. We're shitting in high cotton now, folks.
So
we got it.
So David Kahn, we know him, but like tell them who he produced. I mean, he did Fishbone, but what else? This is he ended up producing the first Human Radio record, but he's. Did a lot.
Well, he went on to some things. Like there's a guy named Paul McCartney. I guess he did a couple of records. A couple
of
records with.
He did the early Bangles. The Bangles.
Yeah, the Bangles. The Outfield. A lot of. He did Romeo Void. I might like you better if we slept together.
Like you better if we slept together.
That's a reason to get someone right there.
Yeah. Because and then at the time, you know, music was kind of coming out of hair metal. It was kind of dying. It was pre-Nirvana. I mean, where did you guys feel like you fit in? I mean, XTC, as I know, is a big influence, and they were getting radio play. And where did the label see you, like, kind of fitting in?
Boy, that's a good question, man. I don't know, because...
I don't know if they ever did.
We don't know that.
Yeah, that's why we're talking about it now, I guess.
It was interesting because we didn't... We, as a band, we were sort of... again, keep in mind, we got signed about 2 years into our existence, so we're still pretty not formed. We're not a fully formed band. We're still trying to figure it out.
So as I recall, we were how labels signed they released five acts in 1 week, the singles, right? Back in the day, the five singles they released. And the week our single was released was the same week that Mariah Carey debuted. CBS Records.
There were numbers tossed around about who got the bigger percentage of the promotional budget.
The number we were always hearing was like 90%. She's getting 90. Everybody else gets at the other 10.
Stupid Matilda.
But Mariah Carey. But I mean, REM's book starting to blow up. Then the Black Crows are around. I mean, it's an interesting kind of time, like there's nothing real specific. I mean, it's kind of go any way.
Yeah,
at that
still.
Point.
I mean, it was a kind of a weird moment in music because it's. I sort of look at 89, 90, 91 as a period of time when there was a lot of possibilities for bands, or that things could have gone in a lot of different directions. Before Nirvana came in and swept the table, pretty much, and that whole sort of thing happened, which was, and we certainly got caught up in that. We were one of the folks that caught up in that net as well.
Yeah.
But no, it was at that particular time that we came out. I think there was some possibilities for the music business that were not realized at that point. They could have gone in a variety of different directions, yeah. But then the marketplace made the decision that we needed a clean house with rock and roll in general and bring it back down to the basics, which not necessarily, I can't say I refute that call. I just, I didn't want to be the ones that got kicked out of the crib.
Wasn't Cherry Pie the same week as us?
Yeah, we came out the same week as Cherry Pie,
awesome.
Man.
Congratulations.
Hello.
Well, before we get listening to the first side, which the first track is Me and Elvis, I think we should talk about that a little bit. What's your relationship with that song? I mean, anybody can go. I know that because that was
the original version.
Yes,
was tongue in cheek. It was done in the style of ska music, and it was really fun. It was great fun at our gigs. The fans seemed to like it.
We needed some faster tunes. Me and Elvis used to have it. So it was up tempo, ska tune. It was a joke. It was meant to be fun.
Yeah.
And once we got in the studio with David Kahn and we're in L.A. at Ocean Way, suddenly the fun didn't appeal to everyone except us. And we're like, well, okay. I remember at one point, someone made a comment, but this sounds like Bruce Hornsby. And the room went silent. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to see myself out.
If there's anything wrong with Bruce Hornsby.
But I mean, it went to number, he was in the 30s on the Billboard chart, which is, a little guy sitting here from Memphis going, oh my God, it's on the charts. And you had a music video on MTV. I showed it to Mary for the first time this week, and it's back in fashion. I mean, like, you got the time, you're like, or a little bit after, but I mean, it's a really incredible video in regards to Memphis too. Like, you guys really feature Memphis.
Well, that we have to give credit to Alex Winter for that. Alex Winter and Tom Stern. I guess they had a group called Propaganda, and they came and did our video. So
Ted or Bill? Bill or
he's Bill.
He's Bill.
Yeah, this was Bill.
It was Bill. So we had Bill doing our video. And the thing about this video is that they wanted to have us ride around the city on the back of a flatbed truck. And when they asked us if that was cool, and we said, yeah, but as long as you never see the truck. Because we sort of felt like we didn't want to be like, on the back of a flatbed truck.
Yeah.
But needless to say, you see the truck.
Well, years passed. I don't even know. I don't even notice that anymore.
Yeah, well, we were upset. Yeah. That's the sort of thing we were upset about at the time.
But they were pushing it to radio, and I mean,
we had a really good radio play. We went to Salt Lake City though. They did actually edited out the guitar solo, and we're very proud about that. But
why would they do that?
Because they don't like guitar solos in Utah,
apparently. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They don't do that there.
There was one particular radio station that prided themselves on never having guitar solos.
Exactly.
It was completely weird, but, welcome to Utah.
Yes. And they played us the ed and say, what do you think? We went,
yeah.
Well, I remember doing station IDs where you would go, hi, my name's such and such from such and such band, and I would go, this is Steve Eby from Human Radio, and you just heard half of our song on WSUK.
That's really a bad butcher of
we also had a reputation for being cheeky that didn't serve us well. So that's
we went 12 hours out of our way. We went 12 hours out of our way on the bus thing, right, to call that station. And they apologized to us before we went on. I have to apologize to you guys, but we edited the guitar because we are AOL, whatever the format was. We don't do guitar solos.
AOL format.
Well, we're going to split up in just a second. I'll give you instructions on that, and we'll listen to side A, and then we're going to come back and talk for a little bit more. But before that, I did want to read on the liner notes. You guys have a list of all your influences from the record. I think it's kind of interesting to hear Before, do you remember all these?
Is it going to take long?
It's not going to take long. The Beatles,
Make
Frank,
the baby pictures here.
This is listed on the liners. The Beatles, Frank Zappa, Elvis Presley, Sly Stone, James Brown, George Clinton, Al Green, Miles Davis, John Coltrane, Sun Ra, Captain Beefheart, Philip Glass, Bob Dylan, The Clash, Talking Heads, Roxy Music. So now you're getting an idea. I don't know why this. Alex Chilton, the Barquets, the Staple Singers, Salvador Dali, Thomas Pynchon, Carl Jung, the Three Stooges, and then if you can help me, this is a Peter, but it's Ramayana. Ramayana. Help me out here.
The Ramayana.
Yeah, yeah, that. So those are all the influence. So when you're listening.
And Jesus, Buddha, and the Wizard of Oz.
Paramahansa Yogananda, maybe?
Used to have a good time. We cash in all our coke bottles to buy a quart of wine. Me and Elvis, we ride out to the park, smoke his daddy's cigarettes and come home after dark. Yeah. Me and Elvis used to really rock and roll. We like to crank up our guitars and then we'd really lose control. Yeah. Me and Elvis, we ride our motorbikes. We used to always skip school. We did just what we liked. Me and Elvis. Elvis and I. We knew how to get our kicks. Me and Elvis never worried about the cops. He flashed a badge he got from Nixon every time that we got stopped. Me and Elvis used to play pinball all day, and the machines would never tilt. No one ever had to pay. Me and Elvis liked the leather jackets black, and we'd ride up and down the river in a brand new Cadillac. Me and Elvis. Las Vegas, and we stayed a couple of years. Me and Elvis watched TV till it got late, and we would never change the channel. It was Elvis 38. We never meant to sing the blues, but avalanches never go in the direction that you choose. Me and Elvis finally made our sacrifice, and now his picture's on my mantle sitting next to Jesus Christ. And Elvis, Elvis and I. Myself some happiness. If there's Ceylon satisfaction, I might just have to stock up. Maybe I'll buy myself some muscles in a California lifestyle, an irresponsible Ferrari, an ex-cheerleader to knock up. Yeah, and if there is some left over, I might buy a leather jacket and a brand new Harley Davidson and a fifth of Cuervo gold. Then I'd ride all night to Reno and lose the rest in some casino, like any good Los Angeles. editors on hold. When every man was million. Politicians and executives, the mighty U.S. government, Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. When every map was million, when every map was million, when every map was million, sandwiches. When I make my first million, I'll look back on this and grin. Now that greed is back in fashion, I'll rebel with real compassion. I earth that stockpile satisfaction, soon be turning to chagrin.
What'd y'all think? All right. Thumbs up. yeah, so that, you know, that came out in 90. I mean, definitely hear a lot of Fishbone on that last song, and just, you know, XTC. And I mean, who else were y'all listening to? What else was coming into that, at, you know, stew that y'all were doing?
That's pretty much nailing it right there. Okay. We were pretty heavily into those are two bands I would say we were pretty well influenced by.
We even heard a little Michael Jackson there at the end
too. We're not above a little MJ.
Back then it was like, oh, that sound. I mean, it's like, you know, there was only a few sounds to pick from, and like some of that, like the last one that's got the kind of thriller.
Well, we have actually been informed, though, while Michael Jackson was recording Dangerous, that they were playing our record in the studio a lot. The engineers there were very much into that record. So I'm pretty sure old MJ heard it at some point. He might have gone, what the hell is that?
Somebody put that on their Wikipedia page tonight.
Let's get that up there now. I'm not making that one up.
So Ross, talk to me a little. I mean, we talked about David Kahn as the producer, and I did a little, try to do a deep dive and find more like older footage of y'all. There's not a lot out there, but I think one of the things you posted, Peter, was y'all in the studio, like recording the backing tracks for Me and Elvis, which are like the three of you guys singing.
On YouTube.
I found it. I watched
it
recently. But I remember, you know, Ross, we've known each other a while, and you just talking about, like, what a taskmaster. Y'all want to do it? Y'all go for it if you want.
No.
Okay. If you start performing, I'm going to make you keep going. So. Yeah, he's like, go down. If he was like, Peter, go up a fifth.
Yeah,
or, you
exactly,
know,
yeah.
Very specific. So, that, I mean, he was almost playing you guys like instruments at that point. But what was that like? What was that experience like going into the studio and having someone just take over?
That to me, Ross, that's to me, you're playing the band, you know. When I'm a band leader, I want to play the band. They can do that, but I want to be the band, be my instrument, mm-hmm. basically. And he was doing that basically with us, mm-hmm. with Fieldy, with me, whatever he was doing. It was like really, you know, what he did was pretty fucking cool. Go ahead.
Well, the way it worked out with David, it was a pretty intense experience for most of us because we'd never really. I mean, before then,
yeah,
we'd been produced a little bit, and we'd had some experience getting produced by Jack Holder, and Jack is great. I mean, really an amazing guy, mm-hmm. but it wasn't quite the right guy for us. But we that was our first sort of experience for being produced, so we didn't really know what it was like to be produced really at that point. So when David took us in, the way it worked out is that we did a lot of pre-production. So we played the songs. He picked the songs. I mean, he listened to all our songs, and he decided, okay, these are the songs that are on your record. And we went, okay.
How many did y'all have at the time?
About 20.
Yeah.
So we picked out 10 of the best tunes and decided that was the record. And one of the tunes was a song that we had stopped playing and we never played ever afterwards, which was Electromagnetism, which you'll hear. Like we did play it twice after that, but. That was a song that we didn't have on our list, but he heard it and said that needs to be on the record. And we went, okay. So a lot of it was
electromagnetism.
Yeah, electromagnetism. So we ended up the way it worked is that David, we worked on this. He picked the songs, and then we did pre-production. We spent a lot of time playing the songs, and then he pretty much fine-tuned the band arrangements and said, okay, get rid of that verse. We lost verses left and right. He skinned verses. Because apparently I write a lot of verses, and I really shouldn't be.
The bridge on Monkey Suit that you just heard, the bridge was abbreviated. It was twice as long before.
Yeah, so there's a lot of abbreviation going. So, but we wanted to learn. I mean, we really wanted to learn
Ross,
from somebody.
So you're a writer, man. You're a wordsmith, man.
Yeah. Well, we wanted to learn from somebody who we respected. So we took him. We took what he said, and we did it. And we fine-tuned the tunes so that when we could go in the studio, we would just play them without thinking, and we'd have the arrangement pretty much worked out. And then once we recorded the songs, did the basic tracking of it out in Ocean Way in Los Angeles, then we did some overdubbing out there. We did some of the vocal overdubs, but we brought the overdubbing back to Memphis, and we finished the recording at Memphis Sound Productions down on Beale Street. And if you want to see the video of us being sort of being kind of manhandled by David Kahn in the studio, you can watch that on. You can see that video and sort of see how he was dealing with us, because we need to be kind of led through this process a bit. We were still very green. We didn't really know. Although we were pretty well ensconced in terms of the Memphis and the community, we were pretty well known as from being in a variety of different bands. We weren't really that. Great at making records yet. We didn't really know much about that. So what happened was we had the basic stuff worked out. So we went in the studio. We could do the main recording part of it. But then after that, then the thing that we learned from David was that after that happens, then anything goes. I mean, now we have to sort of go through the tune and go, okay, what kind of crazy stuff are we going to do here to make this interesting? So a lot of that's where we sort of found out about David, which a lot of the stuff that we were hearing on the Fishbone records that was all these really clever, cool things, that was sort of David's ideas a lot of times. So we sort of figured out, we sort of understanding we were being produced to a certain extent, and we were being produced by a really good producer. But we were sort of in this process where we were kind of learning how to do it and being sort of guided through this thing. But and for the most part, we responded to that pretty well. Sometimes we didn't respond as well as others. But for the most part, it was kind of cool, because there was a moment where all of a sudden we'd have a moment of time in the music where it's like, what are we going to do here that hasn't been done before? And we'd start just...
And then there were hiccups like David getting hit on his bicycle.
And then, of course, there was a moment when in Monkeys... Some of you just heard the song Monkey Suit, for instance, and there were accidents that happened. For instance, there was a point where they were doing some editing on the drum track, and they had all the drum tracks armed on the machine, and we were going to punch in on something else. And David Kahn, we watched as he did this. He punched in and punched a three beat hole in the drum track, because all of the drums were armed, and he erased the drums for two beats, and he went and did one of those, and we looked at him like,
watch that happen.
You did it. It's one of the earliest.
Let's see some production now.
It's one of the earliest drops in music. Yeah, like, so that's like before.
So,
yeah.
So he said, "All right, get over the keyboard and put this keyboard here," and we fixed that hole. So you'll hear that hole in the middle of the ending of the song.
Yeah, yeah, I don't. I've never.
We noticed. Made it part of the song and started playing it live with the hole in there.
So happy accidents were incorporated. And one thing I will say about David is that he was looking for happy accidents a lot of times. Once we had the fundamentals of the record pretty much recorded, at that point then he started going, okay, now let's screw things up. Let's do something weird and just see what happens. And so a lot of those kind of touches, that was right. And I learned something about production that day, which is like, there's no rules to this. We can do, we can really do whatever we want if we want to innovate, if we want to do something.
Yeah,
cool.
He put organic elements in the recording, basically.
And that brought moments. Hopefully that brought some organicness into the recording because, I mean, it's not necessarily the most organic sounding record, we'll be perfectly honest with you.
It's like, yeah.
and the lyrics, Ross, I mean, at the time, you know, pretty political, a lot of, you know, climate change was being talked about a lot, and capitalism, and, you know, here we are however many years later. I mean, how, like, you as an artist, as a lyricist, I mean, how do you feel about those lyrics and over time, like, listening back to them now?
It's hard.
Yeah.
Sometimes. I find myself kind of, I'm not that same person anymore. I mean, I used to, my approach to songwriting at that time was that I want to write songs that aren't love songs. I want to write songs about stuff. I liked a lot of the bands I was interested in, like XTC and Fishbone, like that's the name of a couple of bands we've been talking about. These are bands that were writing songs about other stuff than like I Love You Baby or stuff like that. And I always had this feeling, I want to write songs that had some kind of a substance to them. So that was always my intention with a lot of these songs, and to be perfectly honest, in retrospect, there are times when I feel like I was overdoing it, and I wish I'd have been more subtle. I mean, a lot of the criticism that I have heard about the record is that a lot of the lyrics are on the nose and not at all subtle, and trying to make certain points. And
well, I'd argue a lot of those problems, most of them are still here now, so I don't think
it's
a bad thing.
It's not like these are problems that have been solved or anything, but at the same time, I don't know if people are necessarily looking for that in entertainment and in music. And if you sort of listen to my work after Human Radio, you've noticed I sort of make it a slightly different detour in songwriting.
Oh my God, can I bring up stuff that has not been made available to the public? There is no harmony. While You Were Sleeping.
There's a second Human Radio record some of you may have known
about.
There's
a ghost record, yeah, out there. Yeah. That's what you nailed it and still applicable to today, basically, yeah. You know, yeah. The whole thing. Yeah. Oh, my God. You got to is it on YouTube?
We played some today on my show.
Yeah, we played some today.
And yeah.
Oh, cool.
Actually, if you want to hear the sort of second Human Radio record, it is available on Bandcamp, and you can find that out there. So we did actually do a whole, pretty much a whole second record, not with Columbia, but pretty much on our own dime, based on, we did it with publishing demo money, and we were able to make a second record, which we tried to then bring it back out into the world and get a, and once the Columbia deal sort of went south, which it did,
yeah,
and we were looking for another place to go, we had that record as our calling card, and that was, and it was unsuccessful.
Yeah. So what happened with Columbia? I mean, the record, the single came out, and like, what happened? Well, oh, sorry, I didn't mean to make you leave.
Oh, well, I mean, it's the same. It's kind of the same thing that happens with a lot of records. And actually, Greg was sort of talking about this earlier on the radio. We were sort of talking about this a bit. We got signed at a time when a lot of bands were getting signed. Seemed to be a lot of bands were getting signed at the end of the 80s, right before the 90s. I think there was some kind of a publishing that was happening in 1990 that sort of caused that to happen. But be that as it may, we were sort of a part of a thing that happened. We were signed under Walter Yetnikoff, who was the head of the label. And then shortly after we were signed, they changed to Don Einar, who was the new head of the label. And generally what happens when a band is signed under one sort of president is that the next president again comes in and looks at it and goes, okay, what did that guy sign? And going, who are those guys? And when we actually had the opportunity to finally play for Don Einar and the entire staff of Columbia at the Lone Star Roadhouse at the end of our tour, and we played pretty much for everybody at Columbia.
Disaster.
Well, it wasn't. We played a good show, and it wasn't a bad show. But that was the moment when they realized what they had. They realized that this new regime all of a sudden realized these guys are our guys here. Do we really want them to be around or not? So there was sort of a reckoning that moment where the new people of the label sort of decided that we weren't necessarily part of the plan. And so shortly after that, we were given an offer to leave and not do the second record that was guaranteed to us, and we were given a cash advance to leave the label, which we took. And we then went up to Lake Geneva and did some recording with Adrian Belew we had some tunes that we were working on him. He wanted to produce our next record, and we had a great time working with him up there. But nothing really happened from that other than we decided we wanted to work with Adrian. But the recordings of that were not suitable for getting us another deal. And as it turns out, that there was the sea change was sort of already happening, and unbeknownst to us that there was going to be a change in the music business. So we kind of end up being kind of sort of, you know, we sort of fell out of the label, and then we continued after that. We wanted to sort of see if we could keep going and try to get another deal. But the problem is when you're signed to Columbia Records and then Columbia Records lets you go, the other labels go, well, what makes you think we can do it any better than they did it? So there's you're kind of damaged goods at that point. So that's kind of where it happened with us. We became, even though we were probably at our best at that time, and we were doing really, the showcase that we were doing at that time was a pretty quality, I would say a quality product.
Yeah.
But it just didn't really make the difference at that time.
And so y'all moved to Nashville at that point, right? As a band?
Well, we had already moved to Nashville.
Ooh.
Apologies for that.
Oh, within 1 year, one by one, 1990, as I recall, 91.
91, I was the first.
91, yeah. Within 1 year, one by one, we moved to get.
Well, we had a publishing deal with Sony Tree, so we wanted to take full advantage of that.
Management was here,
and then we just figured that being based out of Nashville, we'd be closer to the Eastern East Coast, and we could, because we were back to starting over again. We didn't have a record deal. We were going to have to sort of regenerate, create a new sort of build our crowd up, because we'd built up a pretty good thing with Nashville, Memphis, Little Rock, Jackson, this general area, but we hadn't really moved out and really and conquered any other places, and so we needed to. There was a lot of homework that we needed to do.
You know what about that? Can I say, growing up in Memphis, and Memphis is so isolated, the nearest markets are 2-3 hours away. When we toured Northeast, holy fuck, the next market was a half an hour. Next club was like
half an hour to the next club. Imagine that.
Makes it easy.
And you know, it's so weird, the culture thing. You know, the iced tea part up in Northeast, because they didn't have iced tea in the season.
Well, yeah, and you've moved to Nashville and kind of lived all over. But I mean, how do you? We claim you as Memphis. So I mean, how do you?
Boy,
yeah.
I'm a Memphis boy. I born and raised here, class of '73, Central High School.
Congratulations!
How about Central High School, y'all?
All right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How about those guys?
No matter what, I landed in a sweet spot in Nashville. Long story, but I'm a Memphis boy because the soul thing, and Nashville ain't got that shit, man. Memphis has a soul. Nashville got the dough. I don't know, man. You know, it's
this is where guys got.
I'm gonna say real quick. If you haven't been to see Al Green at his church, he's still around. Please, he's an iconic, but legendary dude. He's here before he dies, because they all die, right? Please see Al Green.
Yes. And so, how do you, Ross? How do you feel like you fit into the Memphis music legacy?
Well, we were the way that we sort of saw it at the time is that. If you listen to that record and you just heard that record in these rooms and heard it pretty loud, and some of you may be going, where's the Memphis in this record? Where is it? And that's a good question, because we'd played a lot in Memphis. I mean, we were at the point that we made Human Radio, we were kind of Memphis veterans in a way. So I'd played with the Coolers and Fingerprint. I played a lot of R&B. We played with a lot of different things, and so a lot of our impetus with Human Radio was like, let's do something that we hadn't done before.
The Blue Beats. The Blue Beats. The Blue Beats. Anybody the Blue Beats?
Yeah. The Blue Beats. But we were trying to do the Sam Phillips thing, which was do our own thing, which was hadn't been done before, and we were in a place called Memphis that you could do that. So we felt like, even though we weren't really really grabbing onto the blues or grabbing onto the R&B parts of Memphis that are so important to the music, we still feel like we're a Memphis band in the sense that we were trying to do our own thing our own way, which is what Memphis bands do. So that was our, I mean, so I'll defend that, but I also recognize that it's, if you're a Memphis music, and this was a big problem actually when our record came out, because a lot of people who are gonna review the record would see that we were a band from Memphis and go, oh, cool. And a lot of, so many of these reviews started this way. It's like, wow, I just got this record. It's a band from Memphis. I've been looking forward to hearing a new band from Memphis. These guys don't sound anything like Memphis. What's wrong with it? This is white bread. This is Miracle Whip on white bread. That was one of the ones we got, which
I forgot about that, dude.
That's a toughie to take, but I mean, you know. So we took a lot of slings and arrows about the fact that we didn't sound like Memphis and we were a Memphis band. But at the same time, I feel like we really are. And even though we were embracing Nashville as well in a different way, we formed here. We came from this place, and we breathed the air, and we ate the barbecue, and we smelled the Hollywood dump.
Payne's barbecue. We've been here.
So I feel like at the end of the day that even though we don't sound like it, we're a Memphis band.
Hello.
That's my answer.
Yes, it's a good answer. And so a little bit, where are you now? Like, so Peter, you go, what are you up to these days?
How much time have we got?
30 seconds. No, that's one. It's a good time. What did you want? Who are you playing with these days? What music are you doing?
Hey, Robbie?
Yes.
Yeah, sorry. Mm-hmm. We just met. I'm new here. It's my first time here. I'm sorry. I'm a newbie. Hey, I'm Peter. Hey, I'm eating here. My name is Peter.
Oh, you got a tight 30 seconds. That's cool.
Hey, I've done a lot of music through my life with different people. A lot of great stories. A lot of gigs with famous holy shit stories.
What's one of those?
I had lip a joke to Bob Hope.
He gave a joke to Bob Hope.
He used it and he used it in the show that night. And
wow!
I smoked dope with Willie on his bus. It's a lot of shit, man. It's like, but that was Memphis. That was Nashville. That's tough. I'm all over the map. I got world influences, and I'm retired. I can't really play much anymore, but I'm still wanting to do something.
Yeah.
So I don't know about you.
Maybe you and Jim Spake can get a thing together down here.
Is Jim Spake in the house?
He what?
Yes. All right. He's right there.
He gone. Have, yeah. Bitch is shit.
What about Steve? What are you working? What are you up to these days?
Well, in 2020, I was forced to repivot and find a way to make a living. So I started teaching drum lessons online from my home studio.
Cool.
And I'm still doing it. I've got people in every time zone.
Yeah. Nice.
And doing some recording with various people, mostly indie rock stuff. Not any country, believe it or not.
Yeah.
Even though I'm in Nashville, been there a long time.
You are a rock and roll drummer,
and
dude.
I've got a bunch of bands that, you know, bang around in town and don't tour, play a Saturday night twice a month or something.
You
make
a lot
with somebody.
Of money with that
Did
shit,
you tour man. After Human Radio with bands?
Like, yeah.
What happened after Human Radio?
Oh, gosh. There was a slew of country things because just to be in the Nashville ecosystem, I had to kind of get in the back of the line and pay my dues all over again. They don't give you a receipt, right? So you pay them again. And so, yeah, I toured with a bunch of country people and then finally just kind of decided to be off the road and make it work in town. I'm still doing that.
Yeah, cool. Awesome. Yeah, we can clap for that. Yes.
Yeah, you're still doing it.
And Ross, you're in from Troy, New York. So
yeah. I am now an educator. I teach. Thank you.
He buys his own chalk for the chalkboard. This guy supplies his own chalkboard chalk, right?
I bring my own chalk to the chalkboard. And but no, I teach audio recording and production and songwriting at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York, which is a very interesting place. Which is not, it's more like teaching music classes at MIT. It's kind of like these people are not necessarily going to be musicians, but they need this. They need this stuff. They really need something that's not engineering to deal with. So I sort of give them that. I have a nice little studio there with a Dolby Atmos rig, and we're doing lots of cool stuff with immersive and immersive audio, ambisonics, and doing. We have a very very interesting space called MPAC, which is a state of the art. A state-of-the-art concert hall and theater, and it's also got a black box room that has eighth-order ambisonics of 60 speakers, so you can do all kinds of immersive recording and production there. So I'm kind of in a good place to just sort of I'm not really a songwriter as much anymore as I am an educator, and I play a lot of music. I play frequently with Reeves Gabrels, who's the guitarist from The Cure, who also lives in Troy. So
play
he
David
and I,
Bowie, and,
so he and I get in trouble a lot doing some crazy stuff, playing gigs around that area. I play in Woodstock a lot, so I'm very active as a musician, I really enjoy.
And you're the advisor for the college radio station too, right?
Which is kind of a cool thing because actually back in 1990 when we were on tour. With Human Radio, we had a little bit of a residency. We were parked outside of Boston, and we were just running around New England trying to chase fish around, basically, so trying to get to get more people interested in the band. And we had one college gig. There was one college gig because I don't know. I guess we weren't hot with the college kids. We had one college gig, and it was at RPI in Troy. And we went there, and we had a full house. The radio station had played a bunch of our songs. We went up there, had a packed house, played. We sold merch, we sold records. Peter got lucky. it was a great night, and
we blew a circuit breaker.
And we blew a circuit breaker. It was great, and we did a little acapella outside, and they loved that stuff. And we had a great show. And so when that job came up in 2019, I saw that RPI needed an audio educator. I signed up for it, and here I am. So I got the gig.
Meant to be. Meant to be. That's cool.
So I got lucky too, Pete. See? I got lucky too.
I wish I could say I could remember that night. But
I wish you could too.
Well, go.
Are we moving on?
We're in a minute. We're moving on. We got time for you. What you
Well, mean? Can I shill for a second?
Shill. I was actually about to shill for Ross, so yes. You can shill for yourself.
Well, we're in a listening room.
Oh, yeah.
And I brought a vinyl of the Human Radios. Sweet most recent
yes.
record, Samsara. You get a special free MP3 thingy, whatever that is these days.
Well, real quick, why don't you talk about this record? We didn't get to this record, but
we actually got back together in 2015 and wrote a whole set of new songs and put out a third album. Yep. Even though the second album really didn't come out, so does it exist? I don't know.
Yeah,
but sort of exists.
This one you can find. It's on Spotify. It's on Apple Music. You can go to Bandcamp and buy a hard copy. We've got CDs and vinyl.
Yeah.
But if you'd like to get some vinyl,
but
CPS.
Here's the thing. I'm trying to cover my bus fare, okay? You can pay whatever you want. Buy it from me now
there we
tonight,
go.
Okay?
Yes.
you can have one at the listening room, but I'd love to hear this.
Ross Rice is playing tomorrow
yeah.
in the Crosstown Arts Green Room. Yes. With Steve Selvidge and Steve Potts kind of recreating their Blue Monkey gig that they used to do for 7 or 8 years here in town. And shout out to Sean and Shauna who met at that gig and now they're married. So congratulations to that.
Yes, my gigs have a really good power of joining people together.
Yes.
They do.
So, that's awesome.
Can I take 1 second to make
yes,
a quick I want to do a quick shout out here. Mm-hmm. I just want to make a quick shout out here to the two of members of our band that aren't here today.
Yeah.
Kai Kennedy, the guitar player, our wonderful guitar player who is now living in Bend, Oregon, doing amazing things, loving it, having a great life, living the good life. Shout out to Kai out there. I'm going to give a special shout out to Steve Arnold, our bass player, who's a
the baby boy of the band.
Who's our youngest of the band, but also our best looking member of the band. So we were No, he's better looking than you, Pete. I'm sorry. Let's just get over it, right? So and his son Parker, who is also a fantastic drummer and a fan of the band too. So we want to give a special shout out for Kai and Steve Arnold. They couldn't be here, and they wanted to let me. They wanted to let y'all know that they're very happy that you made it here today. So.
We're about to listen to side B. So if you have side B, we'll go in. If you have that on your thing, we'll go in there. But before we do that, we're gonna say goodbye. But we'll be hanging out after side B to just if you want to talk to anybody up here about the record. But let's give a huge round of applause for Ross, Steve, and Peter taking the time to be here. Great record.
Thank you so much.
Technology, it's worth the prices that we pay. And we might lose a species or two along the way. If we can't eat them, ride them, pet them, use them or hunt them down for sport, there ain't no cause to keep them. There's an overload.